Okay, so, can reason tell us anything about God? The answer I'll propose tonight is this. Yes, although it's not easy. But I'll present even that qualified answer in a qualified way. The topic is terrifically difficult and complicated, and it can't be treated properly in such a short time. I will focus mostly on the question of using philosophy to know about God's existence, saying rather less about using philosophy to know about God's nature. And I won't claim to do more than provide an initial look. Since this talk is organized by the Thomistic Institute, you won't be surprised to hear that I'll be presenting things in a way that jives with St. Thomas Aquinas' approach. But I won't be doing that because I was invited by the Thomistic Institute. I'll be doing it because I think it makes good sense. Here's the order I'll be presenting things in. And here comes the outline. First, I'll give a brief sense of what philosophy is in the first place. Second, I'll give brief discussions of reasons for believing in God other than philosophical argumentation. Third, I'll discuss the idea of believing in God on the basis of philosophical argumentation. Fourth, I'll briefly look at objections to God's existence. Fifth, I'll consider the following question. If we have used philosophy to overcome objections to God's existence and to provide philosophical reasons for believing in God, what comes next, philosophically speaking? And sixth, I'll point out the limitations of philosophy when it comes to God, and then I'll be done. So, here's a quick account of what philosophy is. It's the use of reason, unaided by divine revelation, to investigate the most foundational questions. Now, in saying unaided by divine revelation, I mean that philosophy doesn't rely on the Bible or any other revelation from God, but instead just tries to figure things out by human reason alone. What I mean by saying the most foundational questions can be explained as follows. If I ask you what the past tense of jump is, you will tell me that it's jumped. If I ask you why it's jumped and not jamp, you will tell, could have been jamp, right? That makes sense. You'll tell me something about the two types of verbs in English. There's strong verbs and weak verbs. If I ask you what a verb is, you'll say something about action or something. If I ask you what words are, you'll say something about, I don't know, sounds that express thoughts or something. Now, here's the point I want you to focus on. These questions keep getting more and more basic. They keep getting closer and closer to the foundations. They keep getting deeper and deeper. The deeper and deeper or more and more foundational a question is, the more philosophical it is. Probably there's no precise line between the questions that are philosophical and the questions that are not. Sometimes, you know, you're having a conversation and somebody goes, whoa, it's getting kind of philosophical here. Right? That means you're getting into that zone where it's getting pretty deep, pretty foundational. Obviously, if you get as far as asking about whether God exists, you're definitely in philosophy territory. So the question is whether we can know that God exists and whether we can know it solely on the basis of our natural human reasoning powers without relying on revelation. Now, I want to focus precisely on this question of philosophical argumentation for God's existence. But for the sake of completeness and for the sake of contrast, I want to indicate some of the ways that we might come to believe in God other than by philosophical reasoning. The fact that they aren't the same as philosophical argumentation doesn't automatically make them bad, of course. They have their strengths and their weaknesses. I'm not going to say much about that here. I just want to touch on them. So the first way, we might come to believe in God in a non-philosophical way would be by accepting God's existence on the basis of some human authority, the authority of our parents, for example, or by reflecting on the fact that nearly all humans you know, in history have believed in God in some way or other. Now, relying on the authority of other people is not always wrong. Sometimes there's no alternative. Often we rely on other, you know, other people have proved basic physics for us, and we just take their word for it. So sometimes there's not much of an alternative. But from the philosophical standpoint, taking somebody else's word for it is not a very strong kind of argument. A second way we might come to believe in God, non-philosophically, would be on the basis of an experience of God. Somehow, in some way perhaps, let's suppose I've had an encounter with God, and thereby I've come to know that God exists, and even perhaps something of what God's like. The question of whether we can experience God, whether that could actually happen, it's a complicated question. If God is what Christians say, then we can't experience God by means of our natural powers, because God totally transcends our powers. Think of ultraviolet radiation, which falls outside the range of what human vision can see. Or think of the Earth's magnetic field, which sea turtles can sense, but we can't. Well, God is outside of what we can experience, but in a much more radical way. So if people can experience God, it's only because God himself intervened to make this possible. We can't just spot God by looking around. He has to make himself, his presence available to us. So whether this can happen and what to make of it when it does is an important question. But again, it falls outside the topic of this lecture. Obviously, we can reflect philosophically on the possibility of experiencing God. We're doing that right now. And we can reflect on what such experiences might mean. But that would all be reflection on the basis of something that happened supernaturally. And therefore, it's not really philosophy in the sense that I outlined earlier. A third way we might come to believe in God would be through divine faith. By this, I mean accepting something on God's own authority. He reveals it, and therefore we accept it, and we are moved to do so by God's own operation on our mind and will. God teaches us something, and he also moves us to accept his teaching on his say-so, rather than because we can conclusively see it for ourselves. Faith in this sense is the starting point for the science of theology, which is standardly defined as faith-seeking understanding. We accept things on faith, and then we go on to reflect on them in the hope of understanding them better. The idea that there could be faith in this sense is far from crazy, in my opinion. And if there is faith in this sense, then obviously it would be a great thing to have it. What more reliable starting point could there be than a revelation from God? On the other hand, we're not going to get into it now because, again, accepting things on divine faith is not a philosophical method. Now, I want to get into the main part of this talk, namely, believing in God's existence on the basis of philosophical argument. Can we come to believe in God without relying on divine revelation or any other authority, and without having had any spiritual or mystical experiences, but simply on the basis of philosophical reasoning? One way to attempt to do this would be to start with a definition or conception of God, and then come to the realization that God is just the sort of thing that has to exist, that it's self-contradictory to suppose that God doesn't exist. To put the argument in a very crude form, think of this. If the word God means a perfect being, then obviously God must exist, because otherwise he wouldn't be perfect, in which case he wouldn't be God. As I say, this is not a very sophisticated version of the argument. Better versions are available. But Aquinas thinks that even in a good version, arguments like this don't work. Aquinas' strategy is different. For one thing, he doesn't start from a definition of God at all. Aquinas thinks that we can't really get an adequate definition of God's essence. God is too transcendent, too far above us for that to work. Instead, Aquinas begins with only a very minimal, rough-and-ready notion of God. What's more, when laying out his arguments, Aquinas doesn't start by discussing that rough notion of God. He leaves it unmentioned and on the back burner. And instead, he talks about the everyday world. So our question is this: how can we get from reflecting on the everyday world to belief in God? In the thousands of pages of writing that Aquinas left us, there are a number of different arguments for God's existence. The most famous are the five arguments he gives in his greatest work, the Summa Theologiae, Summary of Theology. What these five ways have in common is the following. They start out with some fact about the world. For example, that things change, or that they act in an orderly way. Then, the argument goes from there and says that this fact about the world, for example, that things change, or that they act in an orderly way, this fact can't be explained unless something exists that is, at least in some respect, perfect. From this, Aquinas concludes that this being, this perfect being, exists. Then, he says that the word that humans use for that kind of thing is God. Now, that's all stated very abstractly, kind of very generically or formally. Let me walk you through a couple of examples. What I'll be giving you is a simplified version of simplified versions of two of Aquinas' arguments. But I don't feel so guilty about giving you simplified versions, because the point is not really to give you the definitive version, but to give you a feel for his overall method and strategy. First, let's look very briefly at the fifth argument, or the fifth way, as people call it. It argues from order in the universe. Things in the universe act in a goal-oriented way, Aquinas says. They don't just operate at random, but instead, very consistently, in a way that always, or almost always, results in a good outcome. This is a familiar fact, but it should strike us as weird, because most things in the universe lack intelligence. And consistent behavior that consistently arrives at a good outcome requires the intelligence of someone who's directing or guiding things. Therefore, some intelligent being exists that directs these things to their ends. Having reached this point, the point of concluding that this intelligent directing being exists, Aquinas says, and this being we call God. In other words, he argues for the existence of something that has some very important quality. In this case, a certain kind of intelligence applied in a certain kind of way, and then says that any being that fits this description is legitimately called God. Now let's switch gears and look at a rather different argument, namely the first way. It's usually called the argument from motion, but motion, in Aquinas' lingo, doesn't just mean going from one place to another, which is what motion usually means in English. In Aquinas' language, motion means change in general. So I'm going to present the argument by talking about change. Aquinas says that the world around us is full of things that change, and this seems pretty safe. He then reflects on the nature of change. Here's an example. It's mine, not Aquinas's. Imagine that there's a tank of cold water. It has the potentiality to become warmer if something acts on it so as to actualize that potentiality. Now, for Aquinas, it's crucial to see that the thing that acts to make the water warmer has to be something other than the water itself. To become warmer, the water needs an influx of energy, and the energy can't come from the water itself. If the water already had the energy, the water would already be warm. So the water has to lack the energy and then receive it from outside. Now, let's suppose the water receives the energy from a heating coil. And let's turn our reflection to that coil. Did it change from not delivering energy to delivering energy? Obviously, yes. It hasn't been shooting out heat from all eternity. Someone had to warm it up by passing an electric current through it. So the coil changes the water to become warm, but it does that only because it, the coil, has itself been changed. It's a changer of the water, but it's a changed changer. Only because it's been changed by the electricity can the coil change the water from warm, from cold to warm. Let me read that again. Only because it's been changed by the electricity can the coil change the water from cold to warm. Perhaps you could see where this is going. My next question is going to be about the electricity. Has it just been flowing from all eternity, or did something get it started? Obviously, something did. So the coil is a changed changer, and the electricity is a changed changer too. Can it just go on like this forever? Aquinas says no. It can't go on like this forever. There has to be something that brings about change in other things without being itself changed. This special something is an unchanged changer. Or, to put this in the technical language that Aquinas uses, it's an unmoved mover. At this point, Aquinas has come to the end of his argument. There exists an unchanged changer, and, quoting Aquinas now, this everyone understands to be God. There's an objection you might make to this line of reasoning. We can make the objection clearer by choosing a different example. Suppose we rig up some fancy Rube Goldberg contraption. Does anybody remember that game Mousetrap? You would like set, nobody ever played the game as far as I know. You would just set the thing up. There are really, really amazing Rube Goldberg devices that you could see on YouTube now. They're really cool. Okay, so, I don't know. A hammer hits a board. The board knocks over a flower pot. The flower pot falls on a giant clothespin. The giant clothespin opens up to release a rubber band. The rubber band snaps in a way that causes a ball to roll down a ramp, etc., etc. And in the end, something exciting happens. A bell rings or something explodes or whatever. The last event in the series was caused by the second to last event. The second to last was caused by the third to last, and so on. Each of the causes, in other words, is a cause to cause. Is this the sort of thing that Aquinas is talking about? It is, but it isn't. Not really. There's something important to notice about this series of causes. Once the first one does its thing, its job is over. Then the second one does its thing, and its job is over, and so on. If the contraption was large enough that you had sufficient time, you could actually start disassembling it before the process reached its conclusion. It's like a giant row of dominoes. If the row was long enough, you could have the first bunch of dominoes put back into their boxes and stowed in your truck before the last domino fell. Now, why is this important? It's important because Aquinas isn't trying to prove that once, long ago, there was a God, and that God set the universe in motion. That would, of course, be interesting to prove, but it would leave open the possibility that God had retired or died. All that would have been proved was that the uncaused cause got the chain of events started. It wouldn't prove that the uncaused cause still exists, and it wouldn't prove that the uncaused cause is still exerting causation. So this pushes us to think more deeply about what Aquinas is saying. Like other medieval authors, he distinguishes the Rube Goldberg, or domino kind of causal series, which they called an accidentally ordered series. He distinguishes that from a different kind of causal series, which they call an essentially ordered causal series. In accidental domino-style series, the causes don't operate all at once. But in an essentially ordered causal series, all the causes do operate at once. If the last one is operating now, then so too are the middle ones, and so is the first one. Aquinas' own example is a hand moving a stick, moving a stone. The stick moves the stone only when the hand is moving the stick. If the hand stops moving the stick will stop moving the stone. Or, think of my example of the water tank. The water tank's temperature will rise only when the coil is heating it. If the coil stops heating it, the temperature will stop rising right away. And the coils being at a certain temperature depends on the flow of current. If the current stops flowing, the coil temperature will start to drop right away. If the details of this example don't work out perfectly, we can adjust the example. The point of this is not sticks and water tanks. The point is rather that when Aquinas talks about God as the beginning of a causal series, he has in mind the sort of series where all the causes operate at once. And therefore, the argument, as he intends it, is not vulnerable to the objection that, although God might have caused the world to start long ago, we don't have any reason to think that he's still around. That would be a problem if Aquinas was talking about domino causation, but he isn't. By the way, this has a rather striking implication. If Aquinas is right, then at least some of the events that are happening in the world right now are the tail end of processes that begin with divine action. Suppose you see a stick pushing a stone, and I am pushing the stick, but it's a very long stick, so I'm in the other room. You can't see me because I'm in the other room, but there's still a sense in which you can see what I'm doing. Well, maybe when we see the sun shining, or the rain falling, we are, in a sense, seeing something that God is doing. Something that God is doing right now. It's kind of a freaky idea, I think. All right. So much for our look at the first way and the fifth way. As I've said, these are only simplified versions of these arguments. Maybe we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty in the discussion time. My point here is simply to try to make clear how Aquinas approaches the topic of arguments for God's existence. He takes some fact about the world, change or consistency, for example, and then he argues that this fact couldn't actually exist if we only had the ordinary beings that we have around us. The ordinary beings around us exhibit characteristics that can't be explained without appeal to a very different kind of being. For example, an unchanged being that gets other things to change, or an intelligent being that guides an enormous range of unintelligent things. In other words, the ordinary facts around us don't make sense unless there is some extraordinary being. As G.K. Chesterton put it in his biography of Aquinas, most people think that imperfections in the world are evidence against the existence of God. But Aquinas thinks they are evidence in favor of the existence of God. The imperfect beings we see around us aren't enough to explain themselves. So it makes sense to conclude that there is some superbeing that is free of imperfection in such a way that it can be ultimately responsible for everything else. And this extraordinary being is so very extraordinary that it might be safer not to call it a being at all, but instead something like the source of being. So that's the end of that, of this section here. Now I want to say a brief word about objections to God, or objections to believing in God. For Aquinas, as for most medieval philosophers and theologians, it's standard operating procedure not just to state your views, and not just to give arguments for your views, but also to state objections to your views. And to answer those objections. Wouldn't it be amazing if politicians did that? Just amazing. Imagine what the world would be like. Aquinas lists two objections to God's existence, and they are probably the two most important ones. First, that there's evil in the world, and that that's enough to prove that there isn't any God. Second, that we don't need to believe in God, because we already have good enough explanations of everything. In a way, Aquinas' answer to the second objection is already lurking in his arguments in favor of God. Aquinas thinks it's false that we can give ultimate explanations of everything without appealing to God. Of course, we can give explanations of things without talking about God. But those explanations involve appealing to beings that themselves need explanation. When we have done something like that, we have indeed given an explanation. But we haven't given an ultimate explanation. As for the first objection, Aquinas' answer goes well beyond anything contained in his arguments for God's existence. What he says in this particular text that I'm concerned with is short but deep. Someone who thinks that evil is an objection to God apparently thinks that the only proper way for God to deal with evil would be for God to destroy it. But Aquinas thinks there's another alternative. God can allow evil to exist, but then draw a greater good out of it. There's a lot packed into that thought. But at the very least, it shows that the topic of God and evil is more complicated than it might initially appear to be. It is indeed a mysterious idea that God might allow evil rather than just snuff it out. But it seems far too quick to say that the existence of evil just flat out disproves God's existence. You could have a whole talk on the problem of evil, a whole book, a whole series of books. All right. But I'm done with it for now. Okay, so the next item, we have to keep moving. Suppose you've gone and looked up what Aquinas actually says, not my little cookie versions. And suppose you've done enough background reading to understand what's really going on in those arguments and in similar arguments, and you've considered the objections to Aquinas' arguments, and finally, you've come to a conclusion. You might conclude that none of Aquinas' arguments works. Now, if you concluded that, you might also conclude that at least one of them is flawed in only a minor way. If so, then you can fix the flaws, at which point you'll have a good argument for God's existence. The argument would be inspired by Aquinas and perfected by you. Congratulations. Now, of course, the authorship of the argument isn't very important. What's important is whether the argument works. But you might conclude something different. You might conclude that none of Aquinas' arguments work, and also that the flaws are very deep and the arguments just can't be saved. If you concluded that, you would not then be in a position to conclude that God doesn't exist. There might be some other perfectly good arguments that Aquinas didn't think up. Or, of course, maybe no one has come up with a good argument, but even then, God might still exist. At any rate, Aquinas would not be mad at you for shooting down his arguments. He thinks that if someone gives a bad argument for God, we shouldn't act as if everything is okay, because at least they're on the right side. We should shoot the argument down, Aquinas says, because we don't want people thinking that this bad reason is why people believe in God. But anyway, having contemplated the possibility that Aquinas' arguments don't work out, let's now think about it more optimistically. Suppose you come to the conclusion that at least one of Aquinas' arguments does work. Let's say, for example, that you've come to the conclusion that an unchanged cause of change exists. What then? In other words, after proving the existence of God, what comes next, philosophically speaking? The short answer to this question is, you have to keep thinking. Maybe that's good advice in general, although not always. But it has a special meaning here. It's tempting to suppose that once you've proved the existence of an uncaused cause of change, an unchanged cause of change, that sort of thing, it's tempting to suppose that once you've proved that, you've thereby proven everything that anyone might want to prove about God. It's tempting to think like this. Hooray! There's an unchanged cause of change. God exists. His son Jesus is my personal savior. The Catholic Church is here to provide us with the fullness of the means of salvation. But actually, if you think about it, all of that goes way, way beyond the idea that there's an unchanged cause of change. Okay, you are like leaping to conclusions in a most spectacular way. Even though Aquinas uses the word God in this context, all he means by God at this point is the bare idea of an unchanged cause of change. That's all he's proved so far. If that's all he's proved, then there's a lot he has not proved. He has not proved that this uncaused cause has a mind. He hasn't proved that it created us. He hasn't proved that it loves us, or even that it knows about us. For all we know, it's just some kind of force. Now, of course, Aquinas does think that God has a mind, that God created us, and all of that. But Aquinas believes those things only because of further logical reason. Each new point requires its own reasoning. In fact, it takes Aquinas 50 pages of highly compressed technical writing in small print before he gets to saying that there's actually only one God. Like, it's actually quite surprising because, like, you sort of assume that there's only one, right? And then you're reading along and all of a sudden here you are on page 50 and you're like, whoa, whoa, up until now there might have been 10,000 gods. Like, he didn't sort of say that. But then you suddenly realize, wow, okay. How does Aquinas take all those extra steps? To answer that question, I'd have to go through all of them, and we would be here all night. So I'm not going to, you'll be glad. But I will make one very important point. To a significant extent, the further argumentation that Aquinas goes through is the unfolding of the idea of God that he arrives at in his initial five ways. What the five proofs have in common is that God is where the buck stops. He's not just a cause, he's an uncaused cause. He gives, but what he gives, he didn't receive from anywhere else. He didn't receive it from anywhere else because just by his very nature, he already had it. To put it differently, he is necessarily completely perfect. From that insight, Aquinas is able to go on to argue for lots of things about God. If he's perfect, then he needs to have a mind. So while it's true, as I said earlier, that Aquinas' arguments don't really give us a well-developed idea of a personal God, they do contain the seeds of that idea, and Aquinas gets those seeds to grow by further reflection. All right. Now then, assuming that his subsequent arguments work, Aquinas' way of doing philosophy can get you some pretty substantial results. It can get you to the idea that God is good, that he's an immaterial spirit, that he's all-powerful, that he knows everything, that he created everything, that he guides everything, and so on. It might even get you to the idea that you should love and reverence God and pray to him. However, it has to be admitted that it would still be a pretty cold and abstract and philosophical sort of religion. No burning bush, no crossing of the Red Sea, no return from captivity in Babylon, no Jesus dying on the cross for your sins, no sending of the apostles to the whole world. This philosophical approach that Aquinas provides in these pages that I'm thinking of, it won't get you to anything that most people would call a religion. It's a philosophical religion, but not, if you know what I mean, a religion religion. For Aquinas, that kind of religion requires going beyond philosophy by accepting God's revelation. Revelation goes beyond human reason. It tells us things we could never prove on our own. And it gives us utter confidence about things that would otherwise just be based on our own potentially flawed philosophical reasoning. It might be objected that relying on revelation is acting like a weakling. Shouldn't we do things under our own power? To that, I think Aquinas would give two answers. First, if God really is God, then he's so far above us that it's ludicrous to think that we could have a good understanding of him just on the basis of our own powers. Second, humans are weak and flawed. And I must say, if Aquinas says that, that really counts for something, because very few people who have ever been as smart and hardworking as he, it's kind of scary, So maybe humans are pretty limited, in which case it would make sense for them to rely on divine help if they could get it. In any case, whether you accept the possibility of divine help or not, it's worthwhile being aware not only of the strengths of philosophical reason, but also of their limitations. Anything else would be unphilosophical. All right, let me conclude with a few concluding remarks. As you can tell from what's been said, Aquinas thinks that philosophical reason has a lot of power to learn about the existence and nature of God. At the same time, he also thinks that philosophical reason has serious limits. Some of those limits are practical. Philosophy takes a lot of time. It's easy to make mistakes. Some of those limits are limits in principle. God so transcends the human mind that many important truths about God simply cannot be discovered by humans without divine revelation. It's important to see both the power and the limits of philosophical reason. If all we see are the limits, then we'll think there can't really be any dialogue between Christian believers and non-believers. Religion to us would be exclusively based on faith, and those who aren't believers would seem to have no access to God in any way unless they had accepted divine revelation. So that would be a disadvantage of thinking that philosophy had nothing to say. There's another problem if philosophy has nothing to say about God. Of course, divine revelation is adequate. I mean, it would be silly to say divine revelation is pretty good, right? Like, that doesn't make sense. But it might not be adequate for us, given our limitations. Revelation is hard to understand. Sometimes the Bible makes you think that God is an immaterial spirit, and then you turn the page and you read something about God's holy arm, not to mention his footstool. Philosophical reason can help us come up with intellectually solid and rigorous interpretations of Scripture, which sometimes uses a lot of figurative and metaphorical language. Again, the point isn't that the Bible needs philosophy, but that we need philosophy to understand the Bible. Cardinal Ratzinger, you know, later Pope Benedict, that guy, said once that it wasn't a coincidence, but divine providence, that the Son of God became incarnate at a time and place when philosophy had made enough progress that people could have a solid understanding of what had occurred. Having praised philosophy both for its ability to give us access to God without revelation and for its ability to help us understand revelation, let me now end with a reminder that it has limits. St. Augustine compared the philosopher without faith to a traveler who was on the top of a hill and who can from there catch a glimpse of where he needs to go, but who can't figure out how to get there. Only through revelation as a guide can we actually find the right path. So I think Aquinas would say this: philosophy is important, but it's not enough to tell you everything you need to know. Thank you. So we have time for questions, hopefully lots of time. This is the fun part for me. Yeah?
What is meant by, I guess you use the word perfect and imperfect and flawed a lot. What's meant by that in these contexts?
Good question. So everybody hear that? So what's meant by perfect, imperfect, flawed? There's actually there's a distinction. There's sort of two ways to be perfect. One way to be perfect is that there's a certain kind that you belong to. There's a certain, you have a certain nature. Let's say you're a game of bowling, okay? Now, a game of bowling can go really, really badly and get something, a person gets 0 points. I don't know whether that's actually ever been done, but you could do it. Or you could get, you know, a mediocre amount of points. But it's interesting fact about bowling that you can max out the number of points. There's just an upper limit. It's 300. It's called a perfect game, right? Now, A perfect game is pretty cool. But, and so, well, so what makes the game perfect is that it's maxed out all the potentiality that's there in that kind of thing, a game of bowling. But there's lots of things that are still possible ways of being that don't belong to a game of bowling, even to a perfect game. So, for example, a perfect game can't fly, it can't cure cancer, etc. So there's lots of kinds of reality that don't belong to even to a perfect game. So the other sense of perfect is that something has every kind of reality that there is, somehow or other. Now, what Aquinas thinks is that God is perfect in that second sense. I mean, I guess he's perfect in the first sense, too. But the kind of thing that God is, quote-unquote kind of thing, isn't a normal kind. Normally, created things, the kind of thing they are, it is what it is by contrast with other things. So part of what makes bowling bowling is that you don't use golf clubs. And part of what makes golf golf is, I don't know, whatever. You know, you don't play it on ice. Not usually, anyway. I mean, you could. So, I'm just thinking what that would be like. So the contrasts of things are part of what makes them what they are, and those contrasts come about through limits. So normally, when you talk about the kind of something, you're talking about limitations that make it what it is. But so if you want to say that God is a kind of being, I mean, I guess you could say that, but it's very misleading because he doesn't have limits. So Aquinas' idea is that every way that something could be, God has it. This is the part that's really hard to understand, though. He has it, but at least normally you would say he has it in a kind of superior way, or the technical philosophical word here is in an eminent way. So he has a higher version of it. So you might think, well, hold on. You know, squirrels have tails, and that's really great. So you're telling me that God has a tail? Is this like extra fluffy? Is that the point? And that can't be right, right? So I mean, this is an example of like where you have to like haul philosophy in. So you would say something like this. Whatever's good about having a tail, God has that. I don't know what's so great about having a tail. But I think they're pretty useful for squirrels. I mean, we have to think about this.
They escape predation.
Yeah, they escape
predation. That is the purpose of a squirrel's head.
Yeah. How does it help it escape predation? It helps it stay balanced.
The hawk attacks the tail, not the body.
No kidding. I thought it was mostly for balance.
No, a squirrel's head.
Lizards shed their tail.
What?
Lizards can shed their tail and that can distract the...
Oh, wow.
So
that's so
like
cool.
A kangaroo, that would be the balance.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, I can see that. it's kind of like, I mean, that's like a military thing, right? They like shoot out metal and it confuses the heat-seeking missile.
But God doesn't have predators, so he doesn't...
Yeah, right. Right, so you have to keep pushing this. No, but this is the path, right? So you say, well, okay. So somehow God is completely unassailable, and, you know, can't be damaged in any way. So what the squirrel gets out of having a tail, God has in this super higher way. Something like that. I don't know, I'm making this up as I go along. I've never tried really to think about the tail business in enough detail. But I mean, it's worth thinking about. There should be an answer to this. So the immutability, the you know, God can't suffer, he can't be destroyed, nothing bad can happen to him. That's that kind of thing. Okay, so when you remember that it's like that, or here's another example, okay? So most of us, when we try to do mathematics, we kind of like look at the equations, and we squint, and we scratch our heads, and we sort of go step by step, right? But some people just go boom, and they just see what they call the next step. It's like 8 steps away to mortals. Okay, fine. Now, so Do they have what we have? Well, that's an interesting question. It's not like they go through the steps really fast. That isn't what they do. They just see it. So in one way, they don't have it, what we have. They don't laboriously go through all the steps, checking everything six times and feeling nervous. They just see. But in a way, that is to have what we have in an eminent or superior way. Okay, so, sorry, there's a lot of material here, so let me bring it all together. The question was like, what does it mean to say that God is perfect? Well, that was part of what you were asking anyway. So, God has all modes of being that can possibly be had. This is Aquinas' like super radical idea. Like Aristotle wouldn't say this. He just says God is really awesome. He's like an angel on steroids. But for Aquinas, it's much bigger than that. But you have to add in this business about eminent, or else you have this crazy idea that God has tails and wings and all that stuff. So then, everything that's not God is imperfect if that means it lacks some being. Right? But it could be perfect in its kind and while being imperfect in that way. So a perfect game of bowling, it doesn't have all modes of being. But on the other hand, as a game of bowling, it's perfect. So there's two senses of imperfect and two senses of perfect. Does that address your question at all? Does that help? Okay. Mm-hmm.
So was the first of this five arguments, that was the chain of causality, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did he ever address why there must be some uncaused cause? Why you couldn't just have an infinite chain of causality?
Yeah, good question.
I mean, like, this is a quick example that comes to mind. Intuitively, it's strange to think about infinity, right? Oh, there's a biggest number n, well, what's n plus 1? So
right.
The counting numbers, they go off. And
yeah.
There's really, I didn't hear anywhere where he addressed the idea that, well, maybe there was something before something before something.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we'll talk about it in terms of infinity. There's different ways to think about it. Aquinas thinks that what we're dealing with is the kind of causal series. Okay, first thing, let me think of the order to present these ideas. Aquinas thinks that if you're talking about domino causation, you can't think really of a reason why that can't have gone on forever. Maybe there's always just been dominoes before dominoes before dominoes. He doesn't think that we can rule that out philosophically. I mean, it's not entirely clear. Maybe he changes his mind. But there are places where he says that philosophy cannot settle that question. We only know through revelation that there was a first domino, so to speak. And that maybe God created the world, has always been creating the world. Now that sounds really weird, right? But what Aquinas would then mean is that what being created means is receiving your being from God, depending on God. And maybe it's just always been the case that God has always been bringing forth things that depend on him. Aquinas thinks that that makes sense as a possibility. He thinks that isn't how God did it, but he could have. So, but if that were the case, although it would be true that if you counted backwards, like you'd never stop, at any one time, there's only a finite number of things. So let's go with squirrels, right? Squirrels have squirrel parents, which have their own squirrel parents backwards, right? But at any time, there's only, whatever, 500 million squirrels, or however many squirrels there are. Now, in the other kind of causation, all the causes are acting at once. They're all acting simultaneously. So, if that kind of causal series was infinite, then there would be infinitely many things all existing at the same time. And that's a problem. Now, people dispute about whether this is a problem, okay? But Aquinas would say that's a problem. Because there can't be an actual infinity. You can have what they call a potential infinity, meaning you can always count more. But you can't, so think of like the number of grains of sand at the beach. How many are there? Well, a lot. A scary number. But it's a finite number. And if no matter how big you made the beach, there would still be a finite number of grains of sand. And you could, and there's no limit to how much bigger you could make the beach, let's say, right? You could always just get a bigger planet or something like that. So there's no upper limit. But no matter how hard you no matter how far you go, you've always still got a finite number. You can't have an actually infinite quantity of anything. So if all the causes that are making something happen now are all happening simultaneously, there have to be a finite number of them. And that's why it can't go on forever. Does that help?
Well, I think that you're, it feels to me like we're kind of comparing things. I wouldn't even call that a series, really. That's things operated in parallel. And it doesn't preclude, you know, I can pick up this bag and simultaneously, you know, she can write that pen. And there are a lot of things that are going on, but the cause-effect relationship is pretty clear and it's easy to establish. So you might say, like, oh, there are all these causes and these effects and these, I guess, parallel series of things going on as maybe a finite number of them. But the majority of them, at least that we experience in our day-to-day life, they have some kind of explanation.
Sure.
Well, pretty clear material.
Sure, of course. Aquinas would be totally down with that. Let me ask this. Why do you say parallel? I mean, the idea... So let's say A is caused by B, and B is caused by C. But these are all happening simultaneously, okay? So if Aquinas is right, there has to be something where it just stops. Okay, that's the first cause. Now, I get what you mean. It is sort of misleading, and it sounds... I never thought of this before, but you're right. It sounds funny in ordinary English to call that a series. Because series sounds like one after another. It's only like a series in our head because we think about them one after the other. But they're all happening at once, right? So if I have if my hand pushes a stick and the stick pushes a brick and the brick pushes the microphone and all that, would we call those series in ordinary English? I don't know. I mean, you decide. But there's a number of things all acting at once. This is not the world's best example because of inertia and stuff, but like just overlook that for the moment anyway. So they're all acting at once, right? So I'm just getting hung up on this word parallel. In other words, it's not that there's also, you know, things over here. Like that's not the point. Just forget all of those things. Yeah.
Okay. That was confusing.
I see.
When you mentioned, say, the 500 million squirrels, I was imagining each one doing its own
events. I see. Yeah, sorry. No, I only brought that up to just get across, to start introducing the idea that there's always, all actual quantities are always finite. Yeah, that's all I meant. But yeah, but you get this vertical series going back to God. It's always just this, and whatever one is going out here. That might be a different one going back to God. That's a different question. Okay? Yes?
I guess now I'm confused. I thought at first you were talking about the different causations. So one was God created Earth, and then there was this biblical story and that biblical story. And each time, the past stories are done, but there's like a causation. A started it many times ago and just keeps happening. It's a domino, right? But that's not simultaneous. So what would be a simultaneous? So what would be this example?
Yeah, I mean, Aquinas doesn't fill in the details for this because he's not really interested in the details. If something's happening now, it has to be being brought into actuality. Well, okay, it might be that it's just like this. For some reason, Z means God today. Zeus. I mean, that's at least it's easy to remember. Okay, so it could be just direct. Like, if this is an effect, something that's caused, and this is uncaused cause, boom. Conclusion. And this we call God. Now, somebody might say, but hold on. I don't really believe that we go directly to God. I think the A was caused by B, and maybe B was caused by C. And Aquinas wants to say that, fine, bring it on, I don't care. Put as many in here as you want. You can't put infinitely many in here. And that's all I need for my argument. So there has to be something that gives to things, not because it received it.
It's a different kind of infinite, though.
Pardon?
It's a different kind of infinite, though, potentially. I mean, we might say there's a finite number of things that can be acting simultaneously. Yeah, that makes sense. But it doesn't necessarily preclude the idea of a temporal infinity.
No.
Go back.
So. No, exactly. No, and Aquinas accepts that it could go back temporally, infinite. And each thing that happened would be dependent on God in this way. Whoa. In this way. So if the x-axis is time, right? Then this may be, for all we know, he says, in some places, he says, philosophically, we can't decide. The arguments, they go both ways. Nobody can make up their mind. I don't know. You see, we can't know. He doesn't even say, I don't know. He says, it can't be known. Temporally backwards, the stuff like this has been happening since forever. That's fine. He doesn't care. As long as at every point, everything, well, at least something, like at this stage of the argument, he doesn't prove that everything goes back to God, right? But that if things go back to God in this upward direction, then the fact that it might have been going on temporarily since forever doesn't matter. That's just a different point.
God still has to step in at some point in time to be a causal agent.
I don't know if that's the right way to put it. I mean, one way you could say, well, I mean, one way to answer it is, well, he's stepping in at every point in time. I mean, there's another way in which I want to say, well, God isn't in time, eternity, blah, blah, blah. But, like, forget that. So, in other words, if it's right that the world has always had these things happening, then just at every point in time, going back to forever, God has been acting. Can I give a different sort of way of thinking about this that doesn't rely so much on this business about actual infinities? Is that okay? I mean, is it okay to like stay, to dwell on this causation thing? Yeah. I mean, if people are itching to talk about something else, I'm happy to think. Okay. So imagine a bunch of kids in a movie theater. And the first kid comes up and says, the kid behind me is going to pay. So the guy says, okay. It goes through. And then the second kid says, the kid behind me is going to pay for all of us. And then the third kid says the same thing. Now, it's okay as long as somebody pays. And if you said, well, nobody has to pay as long as it's infinite, that's not true. The movie theater goes bankrupt, right? So the fact that the series is infinite will not fix the problem. Somebody's got to pay. Now, how is that relevant to what we're talking about here? B has a kind of power to give something to A. But B gets its power from C. Now C either has the power and doesn't receive it or not. If C doesn't receive it, then C is what we call God. Conclusion. If C received it, fine, that's okay. Received it from D. But you have to get, somebody's got to have the money without receiving it. Okay, this is something that, I mean, I actually recently heard an economist deny this, but as far as I know, you can't just borrow money forever. Eventually, someone has to pay. I mean, politicians don't like thinking about this, and it's easy to understand why. I actually did see an economist say, let's just keep borrowing money forever, it's okay. I was really quite startled. All the other economists thought it was crazy. So, and luckily, I can't now remember his name, so I'm not feeling conflicted about whether to tell you or not. But anyway, something, you can't just have everything be borrowed infinitely. Something has to just be the source and not a source that received from something prior to it. And that's a way of thinking about this. It doesn't rely on this sort of mathematical sounding point, which isn't really a mathematical point, strictly speaking. Yeah?
So if I understood you correctly, you said that some of these co-temporal sequences don't have to go back to God as long as some of them have?
Well, as far as in order to prove the existence of an uncaused cause, all you need is one. Aquinas actually thinks that they all do. But strictly speaking, I'm just trying to be really careful and rigorous about that. I like whatever he said was, but like this is supposed to be as rigorous as it can be, right? When you were doing the introductory stuff. Yeah. So like if at the end of the argument, all you really have is that there's at least one thing that's like this. But Aquinas would say, sure, in fact, everything is like this.
Because it would seem that if some of them don't,
yeah,
then that would demonstrate the possibility of a sequence that doesn't, which would seem at least to call into question the proof that one of them
has. Oh, that's good. Let me think about that. Well, it would at least call it into question. I have to think about whether it would destroy it or not. Yeah, if you allowed, you know, okay, so let's say is everybody following this? This is great. So like if alpha over here is part of a series that really does go on forever, right? Then, and so it just keeps going on, then why not say that over here too? Yeah. So I think you just have to say that there's nothing special about A, and so you can generalize. But you're quite right. You have, even though you haven't immediately proved it, it has to follow right away. I think that's right. That's a nice point. Mm-hmm.
Is there any? I guess a lot of the way we speak, because being human is sort of temporally.
Yeah.
Is there any way to remove the temporal aspect from this chain? Because, I don't know, like, you know, the existence that time and space, as we know, it didn't always exist, right? Time.
Yeah.
So, how do you extend that chain of giving, which is inherently a sort of temporal act outside of that?
Yeah. So if I make sure I understand, let me make sure I understand this correctly. When we talk about these things, we always talk about it in sort of the terms of before and after. So you're talking about the idea, the standard idea that in fact the universe doesn't go back forever. So there must be like a first moment, but then how do you talk about causation there? Or are you talking about the fact that this isn't necessarily a causal priority. A temporal priority.
I guess like the universe, there's a start of time as
right.
We know it.
Yes.
What is quote unquote before that? How can you talk about that and the causal relationships there?
Yeah. St. Augustine raised the question of what God was doing before, like what was going on before time and what was God doing then? And then he says, and I won't give the sarcastic answer that someone once gave, which was that he was creating hell for people who asked that question. So he manages to like get the joke in. I don't know why he just wanted to say that. But anyway, he says, obviously that's not an okay one. So, yeah, time is a really tough head exploder. I do not feel comfortable talking about time. This is one of the things I like about St. Augustine. He says, when I don't think about time, I know what it is. And then when I think about it, then I don't know what it means. So I'm very, very sympathetic to that. If you want to say that there's a first moment in time, it must be that time itself is sort of a creature. But you see, a lot of it depends on what you think time is. So one way to think about time is it's a sort of zone. It's a kind of zone, and then things get inserted into it. So like time is there, and then we stick things into it. But another way of thinking about it is that that's completely wrong, and that you have things and things change. And when they change, time is like an offshoot of that. It's like the measurement of that. So if that's right, then if there aren't any changing things, then there's just no time. Not there's time, but it's moving slow. Not there's time, but nobody can tell because there's no watches. No, there just isn't. But this is a very, very difficult questions. I don't know, am I getting at this? You know, so what you'd have to say is that although we standardly talk about things in terms of the temporal before and after, that's what we're good at, that's what we think in those terms. And Aquinas is actually very sensitive to the fact that sometimes we want to say things about God, and the language that comes most naturally to us is actually kind of inappropriate, because it involves before and after and stuff like that. And he's aware of that. What's really interesting is that he'll like lay out for you the way it's inappropriate, but generally speaking, what he doesn't do is then say, so say this instead. He just says, well, look, that's the way we talk about it. It's not very accurate. Be careful. Think about it while you're, like, think about what you're saying, and don't be tripped. And then he just says, so we have to keep talking the misleading way. And it's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
So I might be tripped by my thinking and my philosophical argument. But I was thinking, the way I perceive the world is a little bit that matter and energy have certain laws, and these laws set certain motions, certain events into motion, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you think about the idea, and I don't know much of subatomal particle physics, but if we had the ability to define the most smallest piece of energy or particle, whatever it is, and that kind of like gives impetus to all the other higher order energy and matter, but that would be God. It's just this most basic inherent unit of matter energy.
Yeah, you have to think about how the change is happening. Do those like little things get other things to change, or?
Does anybody know more subatomic physics? Because I don't.
My impression is that the more you know about this, the more confused you are.
Yeah, that's my impression too.
Yeah.
But I thought like maybe we're just limited in what we can measure and know. But
yeah.
There was a theoretical, like what was Adam to Greeks? I guess. I think the Greeks knew of atoms, but not more, and they thought...
Yeah, no, they had atomic theories, that's right.
Yeah, so let's say a hypothetical...
But what gets the atoms to move around?
But what if it's inherently constantly changing? What if it just is?
Well, that's sort of the question, right? So whether... See, that's why, remember, at the very beginning of the argument, it looks like he's just sort of like showing off or something, but it's actually an important part of the argument. Aquinas says that if something's changing, it has to sort of be receding from outside.
But why?
Because you can't, because to change, okay, so think of it like on the model of an influx of energy. If I've already got the energy, I'm already moving.
But what if it's a perfect system of like impulse potential change?
I don't know. That doesn't sound like a changing system to me. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about like a pendulum that, because it's so small, does not underlie any frictions. So it can forever swing. But
yeah.
Like as a concept, what if at that most theoretical unit it has the ability to be stably unstable?
I don't know what to say. Although I must say, it seems to me that in a way that pendulum is just sort of, it's a kind of stasis. It's not actually a kind of change. It's a kind of stasis. It's standing still. I mean, it's moving. But if it's really true that we're just imagining it's frictionless, right? I mean, that's not a real possibility. But then there's a sense in which that system as a whole is not changing.
Yeah, I guess.
It's not an example of change.
Unless there's a certain randomness to it, and once in a while it does something unlikely, and then changes start.
Right, but then what caused
randomness.
Yeah,
which
is that a thing?
Randomness governs the universe.
Is that a thing, randomness?
Yeah, randomness. It even happens in our genes.
Well, things happen and we don't know why. But I wouldn't call randomness a cause.
I mean, for other people, isn't like randomness in biology an accepted phenomenon that we're studying?
I don't know, entropy, and but that tends to chaos and it tends to break down not such complex things like us.
And you could say, I mean, you could say that something happens randomly. Well, all right. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have a cause. It's just that there's no general pattern that the cause.
I think there's a difference between like variation. It's
sort of stochastic, think like genomic variation or Brownian motion or something. And I think that that is different than a pendulum changing direction, right? So I don't think we see.
Well, I mean, a pendulum is a bad example.
Well, but yeah, but like, I think just sort of, it's not like all of a sudden some particle moving with Brownian motion is going to like veer off and cause another thing.
Why not?
Because that can't explain this kind of complexity and beauty, because.
I mean, no, when you say it can't explain it, I mean, that's a statement, right?
Right.
Like, we cannot measure it right now. We're talking about a hypothetical particle. I just wanted to hear his reflections. We don't have to keep it going down that path. I was just thinking like this perfect unity, right? I feel like, is there a way to use science to get philosophically at it, right? And so this inherent qualities of material and energy, is there a way to explain it that way as well?
Flaws always in scientific methodologies, so what we might think as randomness could actually be according to something that we don't understand or something that's flawed in our methodology.
I mean, it could be, or it could not be, right?
Because it doesn't have purpose to what it's doing as well.
Yeah, no, I think this is a difficulty, especially when you get to the super subatomic level, right? Are things like really, like there are things that we would call random, but we don't really think they're random. Right? We don't know what the causes are, and there's no regular repeated pattern. But like when a leaf goes blowing down the street, I don't assume that somebody could predict it, but I also don't think it's like truly random. It has something to do with the wind currents, and it's just totally intractable, way too complicated. Now, is it like that all the way down, or at the level of electrons and stuff like that? Is it actually really random? You got me. I don't know.
And maybe it isn't, but I guess like that's what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
Like for me, I mean, obviously Aquinas didn't think about science and particles, but that's kind of what's missing for me here a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit more discussion of God from that perspective.
Yeah. Did you have your hand up earlier?
Something sort of always bothers me a little bit about Aquinas, and I'm sure most of it is my ignorance, is that his arguments for God always depend on the existence of something else.
Right.
And so does that mean without the something else that there is no God?
No, it means that without the something else, there would not be any way for us to prove God.
True.
I think
but
that's
what he'd still be. So
he'd still be there.
So I think I'm sort of get caught up in it, sort of like in the temporal.
Yeah. Okay. So let's think about this. So like, I'm. Okay, look, to be super pedantic, right? Obviously, if there was nothing other than God, then we couldn't prove God because we wouldn't be there. Okay, yeah. But like, okay, no, but it's worth remembering. Okay, now, let's say, I don't know, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Avicenna, was it? One of the top medieval Islamic theologians had this example of this guy. He's usually called the flying man. So he's like suspended in space. He can't feel anything, he can't see anything, no sense perception. So like, what does he know? It's a thought experiment to get you to wonder about whether the intellect is dependent on sensation. At least I think that's what it's for. I haven't read that in a long time. So anyway, suppose I was like the flying man, and I had a blindfold on with him, so I had no knowledge of anything changing. I couldn't use these types of arguments. Maybe there would be some other kind of argument. That's an interesting question. But these kind of arguments, no. So, but that wouldn't mean that God doesn't exist. It would just mean that my knowledge of God wouldn't exist. You know what I'm saying? So, and it's an interesting fact. So this is sort of a structure that Aquinas sometimes uses, and he steals it from Aristotle. It's a cool little template. So in this drawing, causation goes from top to bottom. But our knowledge goes from bottom to top. So we start here and climb up. But the way things actually happen, it's the opposite. And this is just the way things often are. So if you take the stuff off here, then we don't have the, you know, the bottom rungs of the ladder aren't there, so we can't climb up. But the thing, whatever is at the top of the ladder, is still there. Does that help?
It does.
Mm-hmm.
So in some parts of your talk, you refer to Aquinas' five ways as arguments and other parts as proofs. And I've heard both of these used by many people. So in what way, if any, is it a proof? Is it the same as a scientific proof?
All right. I think that there could... Okay, so first of all, I want to just say that if anybody's thinking of some very rigid, sort of formal mathematical notion of proof, forget that. I don't mean that. I don't even know enough about how mathematicians define proofs to know what I just waved off. But I mean, I know some logic. I presume, anyway. Like, if you're thinking about axiomatic systems and all, just I'm not thinking of that. Okay. I think the first thing I want to say here is that, and I'm sort of wanting to blame myself now for if I want to go over this and check the words proof and argument. The word argument is an attempt word, and the word proof is a success word, I would say. So when you say someone's giving an argument, if I say, you know, so-and-so gave an argument for whatever, I'm not saying that I think they gave a good argument. I could say they gave an argument, and boy, was it bad. But you can't say they gave a proof and it was bad, because proof means they proved it. I just think that's how you use the word. So if I say, I have to check this, right, this proof of God, then it's as if I was sort of like saying, and I think it works, right? So I want to check and make sure I didn't do that in a place where it was inappropriate. That would be sloppy. You could say attempted proof if you want. Now you raise this question about scientific proof. That's a different kind of question. Okay. So generally speaking, the way people think of how scientists prove things, it's not this kind of thing. It's not a deduction where you lay out some premises and then you just logically derive a conclusion. So now I'm just giving you like very cliched, you know, philosophy of science stuff. It's not my field really. But
can I have a note there? There is a text on doing that by Mary Kathleen Cunningham on scientific proofs, applying scientific, like how we're taught to do things in science to theology and philosophy.
Interesting. Yeah, so, like, I mean, it's a sort of cliche that judged by strict logical standards, a lot of scientific proofs don't work. Now, the thing to infer from this is not that science is dumb, but that scientists have a different way of thinking from strict deduction, right? So they use inductive thinking, and people have spent a lot of time trying to figure out what's good induction and what's bad induction. It's tricky. There's a lot of weird paradoxes that arise and stuff like that. So this is not an inductive argument like that. Nonetheless, it's meant to be a use of reasoning to say, here are these things that I accept, and when I reflect on them, I realize I'm now stuck with this other thing, right? If I accept that, you'd have to like figure out how to lay out the argument in a rigorous way. If I accept that some things change, and if I accept that things can't change themselves and all that, if I accept that stuff, then I'm stuck with this. That's the way proofs work. So, and if it doesn't work, then it's not a proof. So, attempted proofs.
So,